Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I want to reflect with you on the climax of the Sermon on the Mount, the command from Jesus to love your enemies. This is a project of BeatitudeCenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus and practicing nonviolence and working for a more nonviolent, more just, peaceful world. So let's begin with a little prayer. I invite you to just take a deep breath wherever you are. Just relax and center yourself again. And together, let's enter into the presence of the God of peace and universal love, who loves you infinitely and all people. And let's welcome the risen nonviolent Jesus here with us and ask for the grace to follow him ever more faithfully, to love with his same universal nonviolent love, and so to do God's will. God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life, love, and peace that you give us. Be with us now as we reflect together on your call to follow the nonviolent Jesus and love everyone with a universal nonviolent love, friends and enemies, and so work for a more nonviolent, more just world. Bless us, inspire us, disarm us, strengthen us, and send us out to do your will and to do our part to help end poverty, racism, greed, and war, and every form of injustice and nuclear weapons and environmental destruction, that we might fulfill these Sermon on the Mount teachings and be your holy beatitude people, your holy peacemakers, people of universal nonviolent love. We ask this mighty blessing in Jesus' name. So today, as I said, I'd like to reflect with you on the sixth antithesis of the Sermon on the Mount. I did a podcast earlier on the fifth one, offer no violent resistance to one who does evil. This is the sixth one, the climax, Matthew 5, verses 43 to 48. In those days, the writers put the key teaching in the center of the text. It wasn't at the very end like a climax, like we write. So everything in the sermon leads up to this verse. I submit everything in the entire Bible leads up to this verse. And therefore, this verse is everything God is trying to say to the human race today. And it's the one thing we don't want to hear the most. So I invite you to hear this verse as I read it now, as if for the first time from God, and just let it sink in and take it to heart. Here we go. You have heard it said, you shall love your countrymen and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons and daughters of your heavenly God. For God makes his sun rise on the bad and the good, and the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. So friends, here's my thesis. These are the most radical, political, revolutionary words ever uttered and ever written up until that time. Love your enemies. They're certainly the most radical, revolutionary, political words in the entire Bible. And I think the most profound spiritual teaching in all of human history. And we know historically that no one ever said or wrote these words before. And we know historically that for 1,700 years now, Christians have consciously, deliberately disobeyed them and set them aside. So my point is going to be, if we really want to follow the nonviolent Jesus, and these words are his bottom line fundamental teaching, the heart of the whole Sermon on the Mount, then we really need to take them to heart and grapple with them and listen to them and figure out how to apply them concretely to our own day-to-day lives and together globally in the church and in the world in this terrible moment of permanent war and global destruction. And so on a personal note here, these words are the why I got involved in peace and justice work. Love your enemies. So I lobbied in the Jesuits as a young kid. And in 1985, they let me go to El Salvador to live and work in a refugee camp near where the U.S. was bombing. And my sole job was when the death squads came into the camp, I was to go out to greet them in the hopes that they would leave because a gringo was here. U.S. was waging a terrible war that killed 30,000 people in Nicaragua and funding the wars that killed 200,000 people in Guatemala and 200,000 people in Colombia. So I went to Nicaragua, right into the war zone, went to Guatemala, spent a month in Colombia, meeting every day with the survivors of massacres, you know, all funded by the U.S. government. Been several times to Palestine, tried to get into Gaza, but Israel wouldn't let me in. Been to the Philippines for a month where there was a war in the Far Islands. Nobody knew about it. Haiti, South Africa, and most of all, Iraq, which was life-changing. And then Afghanistan, also life-changing. All of this as a way for me to actually go and be with people, human beings, who are under the threat of death by my country. I'm trying to actually meet them and love them. And I did. I met tens of thousands of people, tens of thousands. That led me over time to doing so much civil disobedience and organizing and protesting. Ultimately, my Plowshares action in 1993, when I hammered on an F-15 nuclear-capable fighter bomber to fulfill Isaiah 2 and faced 20 years in prison. Later, when I moved to New Mexico and led the annual nonviolence campaign at Los Alamos Labs, the birthplace of the bomb. Why? Because I was thinking maybe the best way I can love my country's enemies is to try to stop my country from killing them. You know, like instead of moving to Salvador or Iraq, the work needs to happen here. I think it's really critical to note right from the get-go that when Jesus commands us to love our enemies, he's talking about people targeted with death by our nation state. This is explicit nation state language. He's not referring to the disagreeable neighbor or a difficult boss or a mean relative. You know, love your neighbor. That's that. Here he says, you know, love your countrymen. Yeah, patriarchal language, patriarchal society. And hate and kill your enemies. I say to you, love the people that your nation is attacking and killing. So what does that mean for us as North Americans? That over the last five decades, the 3 million people we killed in Vietnam and Indochina, all the hundreds of thousands of people we killed in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Panama, Grenada, the many more thousands, millions that have been killed in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Libya, Palestine. Jesus would want his North American followers not only to stop the wars against these people, but to actively love them, the people of those nations specifically. Why don't we do what he wants? I think it's ultimately because we're just afraid that we'd get in a lot of trouble, starting with our families and colleagues and neighbors and lose our jobs, but the government would get involved. And if you're siding nonviolently with the people our government is waging war upon, you're going to get into trouble. And we don't want to get into trouble. We actually even think that's what it means to be a Christian. Don't rock the boat. It's actually the exact opposite of that. We are afraid of the consequences. I'm afraid. We all are. And the journey is to let go of your fears. It's why Jesus keeps telling the gang, do not be afraid and follow me. And he's loving all the wrong people all the time. He's going where he shouldn't go. We instead just go to church and disobey Jesus and go along with the nation state and sit by while our people are sent off to kill and be killed. And we, in our silence, support the culture of permanent war and hate. Let me, a little story. I always think about October 2001, just after 9/11. I was working in New York City, full-time at Ground Zero, and as the coordinator of chaplains at the Family Center. So it was a terrible time, and I was working 12 hours a day. And as you remember, the first week of October, George W. Bush declared war on Afghanistan, even though Afghanistan had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. Clearly, everybody says it all was funded by Saudi Arabia. I came home one night and turned on NPR's All Things Considered, and they were covering the U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference that day, They voted, all the bishops, to fully support the war and bombing on Afghanistan. I remember they gave the count. It was something like 90-5. I was not surprised, but I was so sad and discouraged. And later that evening, I went over in the community house to visit with my friend and teacher, Daniel Berrigan. I told him the news, and his face fell, and he was so sad. And then he said to me, this is the point I wanted to tell you, we should just burn the Gospels and process into mass holding up the army rule book, and we should incense it and bow to it and open it and read the great commandment, kill your enemies. Well, I never forgot that, friends. That was Daniel Berrigan, my teacher. When Jesus commands us to love the enemies of our nation state, he uses that specific Greek word agape, which we don't have in the English language, which means unconditional, non-retaliatory, sacrificial, all-encompassing, all-inclusive, non-violent love, the universal love of Jesus, a love in which we give our life for the other, in this case, our enemy, without inflicting any violence or harm. Jesus commands us to practice universal, nonviolent love. And if we can't say, oh, yeah, we're doing that, Jesus, I love everybody, if at the same time our country is killing people around the world and we're not doing anything to stop it. You see, I think this commandment actually outlaws war, war preparations, killings, bombings, and the development of weapons of mass destruction. I think it actually leads to the end of the nation-state system and empire, because it's calling for a whole new world of universal love in the concrete. He's trying to get us to welcome God's reign of universal love and nonviolence, which means we have to see beyond borders and embrace every human being nonviolently as a sister and brother, to learn to welcome God's gift of peace for one another. Especially we have to do that as his followers when people are being killed by our own people. I think the Sermon on the Mount is a call to no longer obey the war-making state, but the peacemaking Christ, to obey the God of peace and universal love. And notice, I read you the sentence. There's no exceptions. He doesn't say love your enemies, but if they're really bad and they're really violent and hateful, go ahead, you can kill them. Nope, there's no exceptions, no justification, no permission for killing. And I never heard this kind of talk in churches and sermons around the country, because this isn't fun and inspiring, uplifting. But this is what the church has done. All of them gotten around this, found a loophole. Killing enemies is completely forbidden because we are commanded to love them with this agape, unconditional, nonviolent love, which means we can't come up with any excuse to go, well, actually, with Hitler, you got to kill him. You got to kill Saddam. No, you got to kill Osama. There is no such thing as a just war theory. And there's never mentioned in the Sermon on the Mount or the four Gospels or the New Testament. The beginning of it came 3 centuries later when the Constantine Emperor theoretically converted and made Christianity a legal movement and religion and said, you don't need to be nonviolent anymore. Use Cicero, the pagan philosopher. He has some good conditions where sometimes it's okay to kill, and you should all join the Roman Empire's military. And we all went, oh, great. And here we are 1,700 years later. Now, you're not going to like this, but when I was a kid, I heard a Jesuit friend saying, well, if you're going to have just war theory, let's have justified racism, justified rape. And he went through the conditions, justified adultery. It's for a good cause. I mean, when he read it out loud, you just go, that's so ridiculous. All of this is just created so that the empire could take over the Christian community. But it's antithetical to everything that the nonviolent Jesus taught and lived. And the just war theory today, which is various versions, there actually is no one. So, for example, one of the conditions is no civilians can be killed. Well, before World War I, every war would have casualties of 90% of those killed would be soldiers. Today, in all the wars in the world, at least 90% of all those killed are civilians. Now, that we know. So this just war theory has nothing to, can't be met, as well as not having nothing to do with Jesus. I think it's heresy and it's blasphemy. That's why I was so pleased when at the Vatican conference, Pope Francis agreed and said, there is no just war. Those of us who care about Jesus need to start talking about this and talking about it with our ministers and churches and priests. And now notice the next exact words, if you're still hanging in here with me. Love your enemies and pray for your persecutors. Huh? If you start loving the enemies of your country, the people your country is trying to kill, you're going to get in trouble. It's not going to go over well. They're not going to give you the Nobel Peace Prize. Starting with your relatives, neighbors, co-workers, and church people. Listen, just take my word for this. This isn't going to go over well. And eventually the ruling authorities, if you keep at it. That's the sign, if you're in trouble, that you're truly beginning to follow Jesus, that you're loving with that universal love. When you're in trouble for making peace, and really we're talking about the way of the cross. That's why the commandment right after love your enemies is pray for your persecutors. And nobody talks about that. And in fact, since we don't read the actual words, we misquote it all the time. I hear this wrong all the time. Pray for your enemies. No, that's not what he says. Pray for ourselves. No, that's not what he says. This is the first time prayer, we're told how to pray in the Sermon on the Mount. And the people you pray for are the people who are persecuting you for going against the empire. It's a command to pray for, to continue that universal love. You know, we pray for them that they might be converted to universal nonviolent love. I remember, though, when I was a young Jesuit and I was really grappling with this, and I was going, okay, I'm really going to try to do this. I don't know how. For some reason, I was obsessed with the question, okay, Jesus, yeah, I don't get it. I'll do it. But can't you just tell me why? This is just the way I am. My friend's sitting here, I'm thinking I'm nuts. But I was obsessed. Why, Jesus? So I would go around to other priests. Why does Jesus want us to love our enemies? And they go, I don't know. I couldn't find anybody. Finally, I come to Martin Luther King's collection of sermons. It's called Strength to Love. Oh, my God, I can't recommend that book highly enough. Everybody go and get it and read the sermon he gave on love your enemies. It just leaves me in the dust here with what I'm talking about. And you'll have to forgive me because I've been drinking coffee, but here's my interpretation of Martin Luther King going, you can imagine him in Ebenezer Baptist Church. Jesus doesn't say love your enemies because it's the right thing to do, even though it is. Jesus doesn't say love your enemies because it's the moral stand to take, the philosophical good to be done, even though it is. And then this, Jesus doesn't say love your enemies because it's the only practical political solution left for the planet, even though it is. Dr. King said, it's right there in the rest of the sentence. It's like I didn't even read it. I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Then you really will be sons and daughters of your heavenly God. For God makes his sun rise on the bad and the good and his rain to fall on the just and the unjust. Dr. King said the obvious, right? We love our enemies because God loves every human being on the planet. We are sons and daughters of this God of universal love. So we just go out into a world of war and do what God does. It's so obvious to me now, 45 years later. But I needed Dr. King to teach me that. It's really a revolution in our understanding of God. Because here, if you're still with me, in this most political sentence in the entire Bible, Jesus gives us the clearest description of the nature of the mystery of God. In fact, I don't think Jesus talks that much about God. If you read the four Gospels, he's always getting in trouble. People want to kill him. He's hanging out with the wrong people and healing people. And here he says, God loves every human being no matter what. If you want to worship, serve, and be related to this God, you have to do the same. Didn't we just agree to this in the Beatitudes? Blessed are the peacemakers. They are the sons and daughters of God. We go into the culture of war and work to end war and make peace because God is a God of peace. Now he's saying, well, the same thing. God, peacemaking is universal nonviolent love. We are sons and daughters of God, so we do the same. I think this one sentence is the greatest breakthrough in human history because it not only points a way out of empire and warfare, but toward the living God of universal love, and maybe even toward the fullest understanding of what it means to be a human being, people of universal love. This is the spiritual life. This is the heart of the gospel. And this political sentence challenges us to question all our lifelong images of God, everything that we were raised on, to think that God is a mean, white, old man who can't wait to throw us in hell, or at least them, the bad guys. So the question I always ask when I read this is your God violent or nonviolent? Even more shocking way to put it is, do we want a God of universal nonviolent love? You know, we don't understand what that would mean. We actually kind of prefer a God of a mean, hateful, violent God because we can get that. Do we want to be sons and daughters of universal love? Are we willing to practice the same universal nonviolent love as God? And to accept the social, economic, racial, political, environmental consequences of such a universal stand? I think nothing is working in life. And this is actually the path of happiness because you're totally free if you love everybody. You know, I could flip these questions around too and say, if we have spent our lives going along with the United States or whatever country you're in and supporting its wars and weapons and killing our enemies and completely disobeying and violating Jesus' commandment to universal love, what does that say about our image of God or ourselves, our own image of who we are? Who are we then? I remember Philip Berrigan and I in jail talking about this. If we're not then the sons and daughters of the God of universal nonviolent life, who are we the sons and daughters of? And Phil said, I said, the culture of violence and war and death. And Phil said, we're sons and daughters of the bomb. I never forgot that. We worship a false god of war. So I think we all need to get with our friends and start talking about this. And how are we loving our nation's enemies? Or how could we start doing that more and more? And why don't we want to? And what are we afraid of? And has that helped during our life, keeping our head buried in the sand and not? Or maybe you were part of the Vietnam protests or the anti-Iraq war or anti-Afghanistan war protests or the wars to trying to stop the Israeli war in Gaza. And you've discovered an inner joy that comes. That's the consolation. That's the blessing. What can we do today to stop our country from killing our sisters and brothers in Palestine, Haiti, Yemen, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Syria, Sudan, and elsewhere? And I mean the actual physical killing, but also the selling of weapons in every war. The U.S. is selling weapons to both sides in every war, and the nuclear threat, which is now toward the whole human race. Okay, as we come to the end of the text, Jesus goes a little farther and asks a series of penetrating questions to try to persuade us into the wisdom of agape, universal nonviolent love. I wrote a whole book called The Questions of Jesus, you know, years ago, and it with Doubleday, and I found Jesus asked 350 questions in the four Gospels, and he only answers four of them. So not only being the great teacher, he's the great interrogator. He's the one with not just the answers, but the one with the questions. And I began the book talking about Rilke, who said, you know, when you get to a big question, whatever you do, don't answer it. Just kind of live your way, and over time, you'll into the answer. So listen to these questions, and this leads up to my favorite question of everything Jesus asked in the four Gospels. If you love those who love you, what recompense will you have? Do not the tax collectors do the same? Holy Toledo. If you greet your brothers only, and here's my favorite question, what's so unusual about that? If you just, you know, you love the people around you, who cares? That's obvious. Do not the pagans do the same? Now, that's like insulting to the people he's talking to there by the Sea of Galilee. He's saying, well, then you're just like tax collectors and pagans. Well, you know, the tax collectors are practicing, to put it mildly, a very limited love. They stole all the resources of the people and kept them in debt. The pagans are the Romans and the ruling authorities who are oppressing and killing the people and coming through and, you know, wiping out village after village. And Jesus is going, well, actually, you're not that far different from them because they love each other too. But I want something unusual. What's so unusual about that? Isn't that an interesting word? If we do not rise to the level of universal nonviolent love and become who we were created to be, the sons and daughters of a God of universal nonviolent love, then how different are we from anybody else, beginning with tax collectors and pagans, and we can go forth with other words. Jesus wants an unusual, outrageous, extravagant, universal love, the love that goes beyond borders, politics, and expectations, that reaches out across the planet and welcomes and embraces every single human being and loves them and wants them to have the fullness of life, dignity, freedom, and joy, as well as good food, clean water, housing, healthcare, education, and jobs, that everyone could be happy in God and one another. As his followers, you and I are done with this puny, tiny, limited love that just serves our country and the culture of war and the empire and ends up supporting the death of our sisters and brothers around the world. We want to go all the way with Jesus and somehow practice the same outrageous, unusual, universal, political, nonviolent love that he showed, his bold, boundless, fearless, shocking, godly love that kind of sides with the people being targeted, the poor and the oppressed, and then goes in further, the enemy of the empire. And therefore, the love that threatens the culture of war, that threatens the entire nation state and the big business of killing. If we're like Dr. King and practicing a universal love and calling all the poor to Washington, D.C., the Poor People's Campaign, and then says we're going to take all those 50,000 people across the Potomac River and shut down the Pentagon to end the Vietnam War, well, then you're a real threat to the United States government. And so they killed him. The last line has always been difficult throughout history, and I think it's the translation has caused problems. So this is the very end there of chapter 5 in Matthew. So be perfect as God is perfect. You know, I think the word perfect, doesn't it mean to have no imperfections, no flaws, no brokenness, no weakness? And yet isn't that the epitome of every human being is flawed, broken, weak, and literally imperfect? I don't think that's what the original Greek word means, teleos. It's something different. You know, you can look it up and it means going to the end or complete. So I've been grappling with this for years. I think Jesus saying, be like God, go all the way to the end, be complete and fulfilling, total universal love. Go all out to your last day. So in other words, he ends by kind of saying, so keep going forward and making progress in our global outreach of universal love till we love everyone universally and our love is complete like the love of God. We are weak, flawed, broken people loved infinitely by a God of universal love, called to the fullness of nonviolent universal love. So we go out and we try to live it as completely as possible. That's how I read the text, so that we might be who we were created to be, who in fact we already are and don't know it. the sons and daughters of the God of universal love. Luke, you know, a couple of years later, changes that last line, and because, and I think it's helpful, he says, so be merciful as God is merciful. Be compassionate, other translations say, as God is compassionate. That's the same thing, to practice universal compassion, universal mercy, and to keep making progress on that journey. That's the goal. That's the teaching of the Sermon on the Mount in a nutshell. Do this, and you will be sons and daughters of the God of universal love. So, friends, let's all pray for one another and the churches that we might all, you know, start all over again and strive to practice this great universal nonviolent love of God and Jesus for friends and enemies. Why not go all out into the unusual love? And in doing so, seek God's reign of universal love and compassion and peace here on earth. I love that phrase from St. Paul. In other words, that we might know the height and breadth and length and depth of the fullness of God's universal love. You know, as I finished writing this morning, I was thinking, we have so much more power than we realize, because we have the love of God available to us. Let me end with a quote from John and Paul of the Beatles, my favorite band. Limitless, undying love that shines around me like a million suns. It calls me on and on across the universe. May we go forth to love everyone, everywhere, nonviolently and universally in the limitless, undying, shining love of Jesus. Thanks, friends, for listening to this Nonviolent Jesus podcast. You can hear more podcasts and find other upcoming Zoom programs at beatitudecenter.org. Please consider offering a donation to support this free work. And if you can, offer some positive feedback or a review on Apple or Spotify or whatever platform you use, or at the National Catholic Reporter in the paper or online. And most of all, please tell your friends and colleagues and church workers about the Nonviolent Jesus podcast. May the God of peace bless you all. Keep on following the Nonviolent Jesus. See you next time.